One, John Frazzini owns the local pizza place, and we've known John Frazzini just for years. And his mother, we've known his mother for years too. She lived in Denver. He was from Denver. They moved out here. He moved her out here. She's rather old. She's probably, I'm sure she's much closer to 90 than she is to 80. And we were in having a lunch or salad or something the other day. It was before Easter. And I asked her, I said, Rose, with approaching Easter, what did you have when you were a girl on Easter? What did you eat? And she said, we had spaghetti. She said, we always had spaghetti. She said, now, we made the spaghetti. I said, did you have meat in it, or how did that work? Oh, she said, oh, yes, absolutely, a lot of meat, she said. She said, we used a pork neck, whatever that is. And she said, chicken. She said, now, we used to use tough chicken. She said, you know, you can't buy a tough chicken anymore. She said, you just can't. Now, we always use tough chickens. Now, later I talked to Margot about this, and Margot said, well, what she meant by tough chickens was a stewing hen. You used to be able to go in and buy, in the butcher shop, an old hen, and they would be tough as a shoe, but they'd be big and fat, lots of fat on them, and you didn't fry them or anything, or, you know, you didn't roast them. You stewed them. That's why they call them that, obviously. And they were really flavorful, and a lot of good cooks loved stewing hens. So what she meant by a tough chicken, Margot grew up knowing that this was called a stewing hen. And my only addition to it was, I said, my mother used to love capons. Now, capons are a mature old rooster, and they're big. They were big. They're not just young little things, little chickens. And they were virtually, I guess, stewing hens or tough chickens. I thought it was an interesting idea. And Rose was right, and it really is true. Lots of luck. Go find a stewing hen right now, or a tough chicken, either one. You can't find them. They're all grown in weeks, and they're all penned up, and they're not tough, and there's no brown meat on them, and they're all tender and tasteless. Now, the other thing I said to her is, I said, well, tell me a little bit, I forget how I said this, but, you know, did you guys make your own bread, or how did that work? Well, she said, well, she told me the story, she said, remember, she's like 87 or something like that. She said, I was a middle child of 10 kids, so she was right punk in the middle, 5 younger, 5 older, the median. She said, I had to make the bread. Every week, I baked bread for the whole week, and that was a standard peasant thing to do for centuries, I think. In American farms and in European places and all, you simply bake bread for a whole week. They couldn't bake every day. You know, you could, I suppose, but they didn't. She said, now what I did was, every week I started with, get this, 100 pounds of flour. And she said, I turned 100 pounds of flour into bread. Now, there was no Cuisinart mixes in those days, boys and girls. That was all done by hand. She had to knead that Italian bread, which needs... Now, Italian bread, by definition, is a bread that has to be kneaded extra, extra long. It has to be kneaded till your arms are falling off. So here's this young girl, teenager, with 100 pounds of flour and I don't know what, 150 pounds of dough, kneading and kneading and kneading. Then she said they baked it outdoors in a wood oven, a beehive oven, you know, the old-fashioned, they go back to, who knows, Ethiopian, the Old Testament or something. But they go way, way back, and it was wood-fired, and she told how they put the wood right in the fire and got the oven real hot, and then took the ashes out, and I think she said they mopped it out twice to try to get the ashes away and then put in the bread. Oh, I bet that was good bread. But that was in the days when hard work was the way to go. I would suspect a lot of people, certainly a lot of women and female, are you listening, Emma? You couldn't eat 100 pounds of bread if they had a gun to your head. That's a humongous amount of work. But anyway, I thought it was a nice story. P.S. number one. A capon is actually not just an old rooster, but it's a surgically altered rooster. And I will now imitate the difference between an old rooster and a capon when they crow. Okay, an old rooster goes like this. Cock-a-doodle-oo. Now a capon says, cock-a-doodle-oo. Now that's the difference between an old rooster and a capon. Now, when Margo and I visited New Mexico, we had a wonderful vacation down there. We visited the famous Pueblo there. It's still occupied and has been since the 1700s. A Pueblo, in fact, where by sort of vote of the people who live there, if you believe, they don't have electricity, they don't have running water, and they don't have indoor bathrooms. But for whatever reason, they decided they didn't want that. But they're famous for their bread, baking their bread in these wonderful beehive kind of ovens. And they're wood-fired, of course. I talked to one of the bakers, and I said to her, I know she had the opening covered always, when you're not using them, the opening's always covered up with boards, kind of a little door, if you will. And she said, oh yes, that's because when the oven cools down, or it's just nice and warm, she said the dogs will crawl in there and go to sleep unless we block it up so they can't do that. So this is mid-April 1998. Now, what happened is the art historian, a nice young fella who graduated from the University of Washington, injured his back and, in fact, had to be operated on earlier this week. So the chair called me and said, gee, we're in a real pickle. He can't teach. He can't get in his car. He said, his back is killing him. Would I come in to teach him? Would I come in for a while? He didn't have to say how long. So I thought, oh, yeah, I'll do that for a couple of days. I went in for a couple of 3 days. Well, I didn't know he had to have back surgery and all this stuff. So I'm sort of stuck. So here I am, age 69, extremely decrepit, looking very old, virtually in a wheelchair or certainly near a cane. And I'm back teaching until this clown gets better. So, and it's horrible. I can't believe I'm doing this. I'm 69 years old and I'm working. This is just gross. And guess what, boys and girls? Today is Friday, and I do teach on Friday. My class from Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, 4 days a week. So Friday, today, I went in all afternoon to write a test. And guess, boys and girls, what I'm going to do tomorrow? I'm going to go in and prepare Monday's class. Now, is this any way for an old guy to be living? No, it's not. Now, what's funny about this is Margot, she's learned to say no. Now, in fact, I think this very week she received a call from the woman in charge of affirmative action at CEPRL and wanting to know if Margot would come in just for 3 weeks to fill in for someone there and she would be paid handsomely. And Margot's done this a couple of times a while back, and she sort of names her price. She just says, hey, I'm not working for anything less than executive wages and all that. Well, but Margot's learned to say no. And she said to this woman, oh, you're just a sweetie to offer me this job. I flake off. No, I'm not doing it. So I have to learn how to say that. Just say no. There is a portion of our life that we haven't explored much on tape, and we should do this, I suppose. And that portion is, now it's 20 years ago, this summer. Mom and I just packed up and moved to Ireland. And that was a, if you think about it, it's a sort of daring thing to do. And, I mean, don't ask, well, why did you do that, that kind of thing? I don't know, we just did it. And we loved it there. And one of the things that we talked a little bit about tonight was that we found the Irish to be, first off, extremely honest, honest to a fault. You couldn't be shortchanged when we were there 20 years ago. You couldn't be shortchanged in Ireland under any condition. They just were so scrupulous. They counted out the change out loud in the palm of your hand, 10 pence, 20 pence, 30 pence, 40, or that kind of thing. And we also found them to be really nice people. We love the Irish. I think the Irish swear like dock workers, at least the men do. They have a filthy mouth, and they're famous for that. Mexicans worse, but the Irish second. I think I only heard an Irishman swear once, and it was quite spontaneous. They just bit their tongue in front of people like us. Well, and these are things really we have to try to, we should explore about our perceptions of Ireland and what have you. Because the Ireland, we visited an island, it's not there anymore, trust me. Although we visited an island that was, there was another island before us, I guess.
It was in transition.
And it was, Margot said it was in transition. But one of the things we found is the Irish are courteous to a fault. It's thank you very much, thank you very much. They say that a million times. Oh, thank you very much, thank you very much. I appreciate, all that. They're just so appreciative and courteous. They're never mean-spirited, none of this big city business. I would footnote that by saying, I know a fellow, there's a student here at Central. He worked in Antarctica and wandered all over the world, and he told a story. He was worth a lot of money. He was single, and he made bazillions of dollars. His pockets were crammed with money. He went to a camera store in New York City, and he said to the clerk behind the counter, "Can I see that camera?" The guy said, "Well, I'm not going to show you the camera unless you may be thinking about buying it. I can't just show you this camera." I mean, you can't think of the discourtesy of that. And he just turned his back. He could have bought 50 cameras. I mean, this guy was, I'm telling you, he was worth a lot of money. He made big bucks. He just turned his back and walked away. Well, you can't, at least when we were there in Ireland, you would never see that. They were extremely courteous, always thankful, always just pleasant as could be. Well, I have to tell you, I don't know, maybe that bug bit us a little bit anyway, but I would say, and I was saying to Margot tonight, I'm extremely courteous as far as, and she said she is too. So we thank people, thank you very much. We thank the waiter, thank you for bringing our coffee and tea and whatever, And I'm just that way naturally. It seems to me that we are very courteous people in dealing with everybody. And I don't know, it pays off, I guess. P.S. Margot remarked after listening to this tape, she said, she thinks maybe this has been passed on to Emma and Ethan. That they saw that with us in restaurants or whatever, gas stations or grocery stores, or wherever, that we are by nature extremely courteous, and maybe the word extremely is not right. We're just courteous people. Thank you very much. That kind of thing. Very Irish, I guess. And she thinks, and I hope, maybe this was passed on to these two youngsters. I want to record the in July of 1998, we did the Dude Ranch thing, and I thought maybe I would record this, and 30 years from now it might be interesting for people to hear this or something. In any case, we purchased a new car, a Lexus, in the end of May, and then we made a deal with Cindy and her husband to sell them the car, the Toyota, which we had driven for almost about 8 years, to them for a reasonable price, a reasonable and agreed upon price for the use of Ethan. So on the 4th of July, which was a Saturday, early in the morning, we got up early in the morning, and we drove the Toyota, leaving our new car at home in the garage. We drove the Toyota over to Spokane, and we were there, arrived around lunch, and we spent the day there. And we had a really traditional American, too much to eat, 4th of July meal. Carbonized hot dogs and wonderful potato salad, roasted corn and all that business, and lots of beer. And it was just a fun time with the children and us. Then on Sunday morning, which was the 5th, we got up early and had a nice breakfast of fruit and yogurt and that kind of thing. And then the three of us, Margot, Quentin, and Emma Rose, hopped in the Toyota and headed to the Dude Ranch. Now we drove, it was about almost a 5 hour trip there, so it was 5 hours of driving on pretty good roads actually, but still a long way. And we went to the Blue Mountains, which are in northeastern Oregon, and the region is right below Walla Walla, Washington. So that's who went, and that's where we went. And we arrived in the early afternoon on Sunday, and started off our visit by unloading in a cabin that we had rented, and having a very wonderful chicken dinner. So that's how the whole thing started. Now the area itself, I better check the tape on this. To continue recording, the place we stayed at was the Bar Room Ranch, which had been owned by a Baker family. And the Bakers, the original Bakers, were old people, I'd say well into the 70s and maybe early 80s, I don't know. But and now the Baker Ranch was essentially run by the two sons of the Bakers. In any case, it was quite a spread, this ranch. I guess there were certain working aspects of the ranch, but we didn't actually ever get to see any of that, like cattle. If they raised some cattle or ran some cattle up in the hills or whatever, they didn't talk about that much, and we didn't get into it. Now the area was, actually, the mail address was Adams, Oregon, and with such towns nearby as Thorn Hollow, Spring Hollow, and Athens, and some of these were hardly towns. Thorn Hollow had a sign outside of it. It said congested, and there were like two houses in what they considered congested. Two houses and a cat. Adams was extremely small and only had one grocery store, which we went in, and they had absolutely nothing to place with. The Hilltop grocery store was almost barren. They sold lots of beer and pop, and they sold home video movies. And they had like, I don't know, two cans of soup and one package of aspirin and day-old newspapers, and it was really awful, but not funny. And then we went up to Athena, and Athena was not much better. But it did have a gas station and a grocery store and so forth. And they were nice, and it was, we enjoyed this. Margo and I did this while Emma was one day off writing. In any case, back to the ranch. It was called the Bar M Ranch, which was shown two ways, actually, just a plain bar, but also a wavy bar, and then the letter M below it. The area was quite old, and the main building dated back into the early 1800s, like 1830. It had been on the Oregon Trail. It was a stagecoach route. Then later in 1880, a doctor opened a tuberculosis sanitarium, at least nearby or right there, and built a big, big building in the 1880s to house tuberculosis patients. And he was attracted to the area because it had a running warm water spring right from the cliffs, and it was used when we were there into a swimming pool. Temperature of the water, 85 to 90 degrees. Production of the spring was incredible, like 60 gallons a minute. So this thing has been pumping water for, I suppose, centuries. And I also suppose it was once an Indian site, because we were adjacent to, actually, an Indian reservation. Now, we stayed in a cabin. Now, they had different facilities there. I think they only had two separate cabins, and we stayed in one of them. Emma had her own room, and then we had a room, and it had a nice little, not a kitchen, but had a refrigerator and a sink and couch, and it was just ideal. I thought it was a perfect setup for the three of us, because we didn't have to prepare our meals. They were provided by the ranch. Every day they rang a bell and alerted you 30 minutes before breakfast and 15 before the other meal. And the first bell, and that alerts you they were going to serve, and then a bell announced that they were serving. Meals were served community style, or whatever you'd call that. Everyone staying, and I think everyone, there were about 30 people there, mostly families, husband and wife, with children, ranging in age from rather small, I'd say, I don't know, 5 or 6, to teenagers, although no teenage boys were there, I don't think. Only there were teenage girls. So it was this big communal thing, and everybody, you know, the food was all put in one bowl and all that. So it was kind of fun. Good, honest food, simple meals, macaroni and cheese, fried chicken. I suppose most things rather a little bit, for us anyway, on the fat side. Homemade biscuits, and then every day, without fail, raspberries, the best raspberries, seriously, I've ever eaten in my life. Now, the old baker guy raised raspberries. He had a huge, I thought, patch of raspberries, and he seemed to spend a good bit of his day out there. He looked quite gimpy and looked like he had he had been to the front as far as work is concerned. But he went out daily out to this raspberry patch, and every day he harvested these incredibly perfect raspberries. And so every day, at least once, not only did raspberry jam appear, which was perfect, but fresh raspberries in huge bowls, all you could eat. We ate them every morning. Margot heaped her. Every morning we had hot cereal like oatmeal, or often, I don't know, cream of wheat. We all put big stacks of them in our, piles of them in our hot cereal, and it was just a delight. The weather, it was quite warm there, and I guess I was saying, remarking tonight, it's really warm in Ellensburg right this minute. It's evening now, Thursday evening, and it's well into the 80s. It's been a blistering hot day. Well, Walla Walla, that area around Pasco, it gets seriously hot. So we really saw some hot, sunny, wonderful days there. But then we had a nice shower, and we could shower every day. So and so then go swim in this wonderful pool with in 90 to 85 degree water, which would take all the aches and pains out of anybody's body. So it was really light. One of the strange things is the house water from the tap water had a sulfur smell, a powerful sulfur smell. And poor Emma, she had never experienced anything like that in her life. I had before, and I'm sure Margo had, but this smell, this overpowering sulfur smell, it would just about knock you down. Now, what we wound up drinking eventually was we got some bottled water from Safeway or whatever, and that's what we drank, and everybody brushed their teeth with that, I guess, because this sulfurous water was terrible. And Emma didn't even want to take a bath in this, take a shower in this. It just was so overpowering. But I will say as a P.S. that my skin turned into the, I was so silky smooth I could be on a TV ad or something for wonderful skin. It was just so almost, the sulfurous water seemed to be so medicinal. Oh, as a matter of record, the cabin we stayed at was called Brookside because right behind us was a, I guess, gurgling brook and this melodious sound day and night of a softly running brook was quite pleasant and to hear when you went to sleep. In any case, the reason we were there with was for Emma to ride horses. She had taken a lot of classes learning to ride English style, and of course, dude ranches, I think, are uniformly Western style riding. Bigger saddles, chunkier saddles, maybe chunkier horses, although I don't know that that's a requirement, but certainly for where we were, more sure-footed animals. And also less use of your legs, I gather, and feet, and more, in Western riding, more use of the bit and bridle. But in any case, they're two different but complementary kinds of riding. They rode twice a day. In the morning, had a 2.5 hour ride in the morning, came back, everybody washed up, went to lunch. Come 3 o'clock, they're off again for another 2.5 hours. And it was just unrelenting. I didn't do that. I simply know that my saber wounded leg will not tolerate, my knee will not tolerate that much horseback riding. And in fact, Margo didn't ride every day either. So once a day was plenty for us. Emma, of course, was relentless. She rode twice a day, and she would have ridden three times if they had let her. By, in fact, rather early on, I think by maybe as early as Tuesday, the afternoon ride Tuesday, Emma, they had recognized that Emma was a pretty good rider. And I think they formed this judgment kind of in a threefold way. One, her father wrote a letter to the Barham Ranch and said, he told them that she had riding, and well, that contained an evaluation of Emma's riding skills written by her teacher. It was quite thorough and professional sounding. I think that letter impressed them. And what also impressed them is Emma decided, and I thought it was a bad idea myself, but I changed my mind later. She has her own tack box with a curry comb and all that business that she has for her regular class work in Spokane. Well, she insisted she take it into the Bar Inn. Now, we didn't argue. We said, hey, that's fine, and she did. But one of the things that that tack box did was it made the wranglers realized she was a serious rider. Now, the other thing, of course, is as soon as she got up on a horse, their trained horsemen, and the two of the male wranglers were rodeo guys, and the two women were, they were in their mid-30s, and they were experienced horsemen. So once Emma got on the horse, they realized the way she handled her presence and her seat and all that business. that she was a good writer. And she got quite friendly with a Wrangler woman named Kate, who liked Emma. And seriously, so Emma kind of was taken under her wing, although Kate, it was very soon into the Dude Ranch experience that Kate said she didn't have to worry about Emma at all. Emma could handle herself, and that's why she essentially invited Emma to ride bareback. And of course, Emma would, she jumped at it. So, we have some wonderful pictures, I think, I hope, of Emma not only riding with a saddle, but riding bareback. We were required to, every time you rode, to before you went out, you had to clean your horse with curry combs and brush them off, and then saddle them with a blanket and these heavy saddles. Emma, of course, needed some help because these things weighed a ton. And then when you get back from your ride, you had to take off the saddle so the horses could have a little break time. And then you had to curry comb them, brush them down. So they were getting brushed and curry combed twice a day. Horses' names, my horse was named Lace, a horse that apparently had a tapeworm as big as a boa constrictor and who wanted to eat all the time. Margo had two horses. She started off with a horse named Scout, who everyone, the early advice was, don't ride too close behind Scout. Scout likes to kick. Well, Scout was the horse from Diablo Hell, and a quite fractious horse, and I was surprised they gave it to Margo. In any case, soon after they changed her horse to I think Perky was the name of her horse. And then Emma's horse was named... what was Emma's horse name?
Spice.
Spice. Spice was a quarter horse, Emma informed me. So in any case, the riding was fun and went up in the hills and rather daring for, I think, a couple of old codgers to do, but Emma never seemed to worry, and she enjoyed it. It rained twice there, once in the evening after, I think after the ride, and it rained a measured inch. They kept track of the rain with rain gauges.